So this is the last question and answer session, apart from maybe a small opportunity tomorrow morning. So if you've got any questions, now is the time to ask them.
Numb. Sometimes I just leave it, and I wonder if I just leave it because I can manage.
Is it one leg or the other that's going numb, or both?
It depends. Depends how many cushions I put in different parts. But one thing I know. Nothing
work. Is your trousers too tight? They look fairly tight.
Loose.
Do you normally have any like circulation problems with the legs or?
Circulation problem? No, I think.
No. So it's only sitting cross-legged. Is it the whole leg or part? What's going numb? Or is it change?
It change. That's why. Because if only one certain part, then I know that's the problem. Like the other day, it's always here. Then I know it's always there. It's nothing to do with anything. But it depends on how I adjust it. So the question is, if I put in like pressure,
what do you mean, put the pressure?
Without... On top of this, of course this will put certain pressure on certain point. But if I put them nothing on top of each other, does that work better?
Sure, try it. Why not?
So take another topic to try.
Yeah, I mean, just... We just keep adjusting and trying different things, and finally you'll find something that'll work. If not, then maybe you could try using like a meditation stool where you tuck your legs underneath. See if that works. Yeah, you can try that as well. Because it could be just the cross-legged position. So if you try to tuck your legs under one of those stools, you might like to try that. I don't know if there's a spare one or... There's one spare one, so maybe you can try that, see if that works. Okay.
So I just want to say that today I'm feeling much, much better.
Very good.
I think 90% of the anxiety from yesterday is gone. And the interesting thing is that this 10% which are left, today I haven't had any laxity, dullness, all these things, because it's kind of... it keeps me awake, it keeps me vigilant. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I want to say is that when I concentrate on my object, which now is the abdomen, so what I realized today is that I managed to concentrate on the movement of the
abdomen.
Breath.
Yeah.
I think the core excitation, I think I manage in a way.
Sure.
But the thoughts that are coming, I feel like as if I'm observing the mind while I'm concentrated on the breath. It's very interesting because when I'm trying to observe the mind, it never happens. It stays blank. But now when I do the my main focus when it's on the abdominal, there are other plenty of thoughts, sometimes more often than not come. Mm-hmm. But I'm able to observe them just on the periphery, and they come and go on their own.
Sure.
And when I feel that there is a feeling, kind of thoughts which are powered by some feelings, I basically try to concentrate on the clarity of the movements, and then they go.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to ask if this is like... when you feel as if you are observing the mind on the periphery, is this normal, and is this how it should be?
Of course it's normal.
No, but is this how it should be, or I should...
Should what? Well, as I think, again, using the analogy that Alan Wallace used in his book with the radio station, at the beginning stage, of course, you're trying to focus on the abdomen and you just get completely caught up in a thought and got carried away. So it's like losing the station altogether and going to another station or static. Okay. Then, as you get a bit better, you may be focusing a little bit on here, but mainly you're in the thoughts and a little bit here. Then as things improve, you're more here, and that's what you're experiencing, I think, more here and a little bit the thoughts in the background.
The thoughts in the background are like they have like sometimes fast stream, sometimes a little bit less, but they appear. But I may just observe them, like while I do the breathing, kind of I let them go very, very quickly.
Yeah. So again, of course, with this practice, if you notice them there, then you're to let them go and just come back. Let them go, come back. But I think there was a question related to this earlier, was that this is one way of getting into the mind practice, is to anchor yourself in the breath. And maybe, like you said, so there's a difference here. So if you're really just focusing here, and those thoughts are there, we're not sort of observing them in the background. We just let them go and come back. Let them go, come back, yeah. But if you wanted to use the mind as the object, you could... No, but I'm saying this is a possibility. And you know, I think you mentioned it doesn't really work when you try to observe it. There's nothing there or whatever.
That.
Yeah, exactly. So what you can do is have the breath as the anchor and then... really do observe the thoughts in the background and then more and more move towards watching that and less here and then eventually just watch the mind. So like a gradual way. Because often, like you said, when people start with the mind, either there's nothing because they're too tight or they just get swept away. And so this is a way of slowly moving towards that if that can happen.
But if I want to continue with either abdominal or nostrils, which I prefer in other circumstances, I better try to
just let them go, and then you'll find more and more you'll be able to stay here, and that background will get less and less and less and less. But that'll, of course, take a lot of time.
And one something very practical, maybe everyone would like to know, when we do the preparation on our own, first, when I try to, you know, full body, this and that, leave the past, future, and all these things, I do commentary, you know, the relax. So I do this commentary on my own that you do, but I just do it on myself. It's not like I do it on my own and my mind does it on its own, but I just do the commentary, internal commentary.
So, of course, in the beginning stages, you can use a little bit of commentary to remind yourself of the things to go through.
Yes, definitely.
And then eventually, though, it'll become a sort of an automatic process. You won't have to have the commentary. It's a little bit, I think I used the example of learning to drive the car. You know, when you start to learn, you do have commentary. Okay, now I have to look here, I have to do this, I have to push that, I have to be careful there, I have to look in the mirror. And we have this commentary to remind us what to do. But then eventually it becomes, we're not having the commentary. So that'll happen. You won't have that commentary so much anymore.
Okay. Thank you.
One very general question. Once this was first time for me to join this kind of retreat, I read something beforehand, but now we've been here and you've been giving us these excellent lectures. Thank you. You have used. We have also discussed that you have referred to other meditation practices and so on. So I would love to have some overall picture of the all practices compare. And I did some to internet, but once you are here now, what reference do you recommend? Book, article?
I mean, that would really depend a little bit on the sort of tradition that you wanted to follow. Because different traditions, I mean, there's two, within Buddhism, there's two main sort of groupings there's what's called the Theravada traditions and the Mahayana traditions.
Yeah.
And within the Theravada traditions, they have a certain emphasis and perspective. And so within the Theravada traditions, which includes like Sri Lankan Buddhism, Burmese, Thai, and so forth, they have a particular approach to practice fairly similar. And then you have the Mahayana camp of traditions, you know, like Zen, Chinese, Korean, Tibetan, and so forth.
Yeah.
And they have all the perspective of enlightenment, and then they have their own sort of way of packaging. So it really would depend a lot on the tradition on how to package. But within that, in all of the traditions, we talk about the three core areas of practice, of the ethics. So we have an ethical basis. Then we have the concentration, which is what we've been doing here, the shamatha. And then on top of that, the wisdom practice or vipassana practice. And then to balance the vipassana practice with the compassion wing, these four immeasurables. So these are sort of the core areas of practice. And then, of course, a lot of other things depending on the school. And but if you're interested in like the Tibetan Buddhist approach, and, you know, we've been following Alan Wallace here, he's got a book called Tibetan Buddhism from the Ground Up.
Yeah.
So you could read that to get a sort of an overview of the different aspects. But I mean, even in Tibetan Buddhism, there's like four different schools, and they package it there.
Like in every, I mean,
yeah.
Yes. But that was good. I could check this.
Yeah.
But do you then, in addition, do you have some book or article or website in mind which gives an overall of just what you explained this whole? Because I like to have it.
Yeah, again, generally presentations are for that sort of thing are presented from a certain tradition's perspective.
Okay. So they go that.
One book actually I found surprisingly useful, but when I first saw it I thought, oh no, it's called The Buddhism for Dummies. I mean, actually, it's quite well written. I know one of the guys who was one of the authors of it, and it has a lot of useful snippets in there. So actually, I found it surprisingly quite good. Actually, when I first saw it, I thought, oh no, and I flicked through it.
Because very often, when there is some article or book about some particular area,
yeah.
Goes directly to these terms and
sure.
definitions, and I'm expecting that everybody is understanding.
So, I think the Buddhism for
Dummies, yeah. The first step.
Yeah, I mean, this Buddhism for Dummies books, I think it has a little bit of a bit of everything sort of put together. So that could be something to look at.
Even if I'd like to then
Yeah, and then of course, if you have a particular interest in Tibetan Buddhism or Zen, then the best would be to look for a very good overview book within that tradition.
Yeah.
That would be the way to go. Yeah. Then, of course, when we have those sorts of things, again, the first line approach, of course, in the shamatha practice is to, if something comes up, let it go, let it go, let it go. But, of course, if there's something there that's really coming up all the time and it's overwhelming us, then we need to work with that outside of the shamatha practice in a separate way. And of course, within Buddhism, when we talk about mental afflictions and issues like this, there are quite a number of different ways of approaching them. So some are very general, like a lot of these issues are coming because of our fundamental ignorance in terms of our understanding of how we exist and the world around us exists. And so one approach to these sorts of things is to look at the wisdom practice to come to understand reality, and that can undermine a lot of this. Of course, we can also then go to the compassion wing of the practice and apply some of the practices within the compassion wing, particularly if it's maybe like an anger issue or, you know, something like that. Then we can apply that side of the various practices in that way. And then often you'll find within Buddhism for particular types of mental afflictions, there are very specific, direct sort of antidotes. For example, like one of the things is like if you have a lot of craving and attachment for things, then one antidote to that is to reflect on impermanence, the transient nature of things, because then there's nothing to sort of grab hold of. And so, and then, of course, with anger, loving kindness, and so there are general approaches, particularly using wisdom and compassion, and then there are specific direct antidotes depending if it's a specific case. Having said that, I think one area that maybe we could go outside of Buddhism to deal with these some of these sorts of things is if we're, you know, in psychology we talk a lot about the shadow, you know, if we're sort of suppressing a lot of stuff, then I think sometimes within psychology there can be actually better approaches to dealing with these sorts of things than simply within Buddhism. So that's where I think psychology can complement Buddhism in that way. So it may be that you could find with some of those sort of traumas, early childhood traumas and those sorts of things, I think it could be useful to use a combination of, particularly within Buddhism, the mindfulness approach to simply become aware of it, and then maybe using some of the approaches in psychology, particularly in some of the more modern branches that are actually using Buddhist ideas to work with that. So, you know, like there's the, you know, cognitive, like for example, cognitive, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, which is used a lot for using mindfulness as a basis for working particularly with depression, for example. So, I mean, I think these sorts of areas is a big area now that's really a lot of work being done, and I think this is where the combination can really come up with some very useful tools to deal with these, because from a Buddhist perspective, the tools, I mean, it's assumed we have a sort of minimum level of mental health to begin with, but of course if we're somehow below that, then we need to look outside of Buddhism maybe to pull in some things for that, particularly these sort of suppressed and repressed and these sort of traumas and so forth. That's where I think outside of Buddhism you can supplement. But if it's just a sort of ongoing anger issue or something that's coming up, then we can use a lot of effective tools in Buddhism, again, using primarily the mindfulness as a beginning point, and then using particularly these two aspects of the wisdom and compassion to look at those issues outside of that and work through them using those different perspectives. So I think that's where that could be very helpful. Right.
How do you actually apply this?
Sure. So, yeah. Like, for example, yes, I mean, the initial point, of course, is to when the craving and attachment for something comes up, at that time, reflect on the transient nature of that object and that it's constantly changing. Actually, one thing that just brings to mind now, I think it was many years ago, I was in the Tate Gallery in London, and one of the art exhibitions was actually this person had a beautiful bowl of fruit, really, like, really beautiful, and they did time-lapse photography on it over a period of, like, 2 months. Mm-hmm. And then they showed it in, like, 20 seconds. And then it went from, like this, and I thought that was very good. But what we need to do is, see, The thing is that just doing that is probably not going to be enough, because these things like craving and attachment and other mental afflictions, they're very strong and habitual, and they usually sort of overwhelm us. So we need something strong opposite, and just some intellectual knowledge, for example, of impermanence, it'll help to reflect on the fact that this is changing, it's not going to stay like that forever. That'll help. But if we can bring those things into experience, if we can internalize that, so if we can actually, as one of our meditative practices, for example, meditate on impermanence, so that it's not just an intellectual idea, but it actually becomes our lived experience by internalizing it through meditation, then what you're going to find is that we start to more naturally see things around us as in a state of flow and change. And if we naturally see things in a state of flow and change, it's actually quite hard for attachment to come up in the first place, because there's nothing to grab, because everything's a flow. We see everything as a flow, which it is, of course. I mean, we know that intellectually, that everything's flowing, but experientially, things seem very static, don't they? They seem very solid and unchanging. But actually, that's not reality, is it? I mean, science has proven 100%. There's no stable, static thing in the universe. Everything's changing. And we intellectually know that, but that's not strong enough to work against our habits, because our instinctive habit is to see things as very stable, static, and unchanging. That's why attachment can grab them, because there's something it thinks is stable and static I can hold on to. But so that's why it's important with all of these antidotes to, first, of course, to understand the antidote intellectually, but then to work on that antidote and bring it into our lived experience through meditation and integration into daily life. Because then we can get to the point where that mental affliction doesn't even come up in the first place, because we are seeing reality in a correct way, or we're seeing things in a proper perspective. So that's where the longer term is going to be very effective, if we don't just leave it as a set of intellectual ideas of what to try to do when something comes up. And with all of these antidotes, I think the key is what we've been doing in this shamatha practice, is cultivating mindfulness. Because if we really can't, if we don't have mindfulness, what we often find, of course, in daily life is that some mental affliction comes up, and before we know it, it's overwhelmed us. And once it's overwhelmed us, there's not really much we can do except get out of that situation that's provoking it, you know, which is a last-ditch resort. Just get out of there. I mean, that's not really a solution, but so the key with all of these things is to be able to catch these mental afflictions early, as they're starting to come up. Now, generally, we're not very good at that because our attention skills are pretty poor. It's only when the attachment or craving is quite strong do we realize it, and then we're sort of already out of control, and then it's hard to do anything. So if we can, through particularly shamatha practice, if we can really improve our mindfulness, we'll start to notice the beginnings of that attachment. You know, maybe we'll notice a little bit of tightening in the body. We'll start to know a little bit of agitation in the mind. And then we'll go, hang on, what's going on here? And then we're still in control. We can do something at that time. And then we can use all these different antidotes to work to overcome that attachment. So that is, I think, key in a lot of this. Yeah.
Sometimes, like today,
yeah.
Happened, last day,
yeah.
The previous days were fine.
Sure.
But today, I think I relaxed enough.
Yeah, sure.
And then it kind of came up.
Yeah. So therefore, like I said, when you start to notice that coming up, and if you can notice it before it really comes up too strong, then by learning and working with these other approaches, then we can pick one of those and use that at that time to work with that. And then, like I said, then there may be some areas outside of Buddhism, more in psychology, that can really be helpful, if particularly it's, you know, some early childhood trauma or something like that. I think that's where some modern therapies and psychology can really supplement to a lot of these practices.
That might be a good theory. That's mindfulness-based, mindfulness combined with cognitive behavioral therapy. It's called DBT. It's originally developed for borderline, and I think it's interesting for a larger group.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of work going on in these sorts of areas, and it's, I think that's in these sorts of areas, this overlap area. I think in the next 5-10 years, I think we're going to find a lot of useful work doing, a lot of for helpful for people. Yeah. Anything else? Yeah.
I just want to say that over the course of this week, I could really sense how the quality of the silence is changing, and it was a beautiful experience. Mm-hmm. I've meditated with people before, but it was never kind of this intense and profound. And of course, it went in waves and this fidgeting and so on. But
sure.
I think overall, the texture of the stillness here got deeper, and I could sense it. And
very good.
And it was really, absolutely something.
Yes, and that's certainly true. That and that's probably one of the things I'm going to mention tomorrow morning, but I'll bring it in now, is that when we start to do retreats, then this sort of group environment, this is for one reason why it's so conducive, is that you have that group energy there that really you can ride on, this group energy, apart from the fact that it's guided and, you know, you just have to turn up. But apart from that, I think that group energy can really make a big difference. It can really motivate us and really lift us in our practice. Very helpful. Anything else anyone would like to bring up? Another question?
One small one. So for the awareness of awareness, can we, because today when we ended up the meditation on Tongan, I think.
Sure.
We ended up with awareness of awareness. And is it okay to kind of picture, not picture, but to kind of expand your awareness like a lot and everywhere? Like I see it in the sky, around the trees,
sure.
everywhere.
Sure.
But as if it has like a physical, there is something physical to it. I mean, it doesn't have a boundary, but it feels physical.
Yeah. So again, that sort of thing can be helpful to avoid this contraction that we usually do with our awareness. You know, we contract and it feels like our mind is very small and constricted. So, and we did that in one of the meditations earlier, this, you know, going up, left, right,
yeah,
down.
Yeah,
and, yeah. So here also, when resting in awareness, we can, as part of that, you know, we can imagine that the awareness sort of goes out and out and out and out, and then rest in that spaciousness.
Yes. So this is good.
It's okay, yeah.
Okay.
Nothing more?
But it's a very theoretical question.
Okay.
Can you explain the relation between vipassana practice or insight meditation and analytical meditation? Is it just different approaches to the same thing, I guess?
Okay. Of course, there are many different types of meditations. And there are many ways of grouping meditations. Often in Tibetan Buddhism, they group them into these two, what's called stabilizing, which is what we've been doing, is to stabilize the mind, shamatha practice, and then everything else is like analytical. And so analytical is investigation. And so in analytical can be vipassana practice, wisdom practice, loving kindness, compassion. All of these things go into analytical. So analytical is the overall group, and within that, one of the main types of analytical is wisdom practice, vipassana practice. So vipassana practice is an analytical meditation. But not all analytical meditations are Vipassana, because loving kindness, compassion, Tonglen, this is also analytical meditation.
Clarity. With clarity. Is that very obvious when you know that you're sleeping but you are awake?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the... There are a number of ways, for example, to develop like lucid dreaming, and one of them is this approach of trying to maintain awareness as you're falling asleep into the dream state. And of course, if you're aware in the sleep state, that's lucid sleep. And so, I mean, this is one of the approaches for that, is to go through that, and you can train that, you can manage to do that.
Well, the body is kind of sleeping, but since
generally before you're asleep, I think the body gets to a point where it sort of freezes, and so you can sort of like be aware, and then but the body's not sort of moving, but you're still not quite asleep yet. And then of course you can, what's called the hypnagogic state is that when you're going through that to get into the deep sleep. And also then sometimes you'll notice some like electrical jolt in the body and so forth. These are all often happens in that process. So you can sort of become aware of this even before you're asleep. That was very interesting. Okay, no more questions. Then we'll finish with the Shavasana meditation now, since we're not having a session this evening. Allow your awareness to descend into the body, filling the entire space of the body. Simply becoming aware of sensations throughout the body. Using the out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension in any part of the body. Softening and relaxing all the muscles in the face. The mouth and jaw soft and relaxed. and all the muscles around the eyes soft and relaxed. Allowing the entire body to become completely relaxed, completely at ease. Relaxing more deeply with each out-breath. With each out-breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen. Bringing the mind into the present moment. Focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. maintaining that ongoing flow of mindfulness, of the sensations of the breath, throughout the entire cycle of each in and out breath. And in conclusion, we can dedicate the positive potential that we've gathered here today, but also the positive potential we've accumulated throughout this retreat. We can dedicate all of this towards cultivating a calm, clear and focused mind, developing our attention skills, becoming the masters of our mind. And we can also dedicate all of this to cultivating loving kindness and compassion towards ourselves and everyone else. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid, and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power, and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then, may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world.